Welcome to today's episode of Fire in the Belly. This is where we get to hear some pretty inspiring stories from some amazing people. You know, it's always an absolute pleasure to sit down, take time out, and have a warts and all conversation about their journey. I'm always intrigued by what it's taken for people to get to where they are today. And hopefully, in this interview, we get to hear some more about that. From this, my mission is to help people to find their own fire in their belly, and from that, to live the mightiest version of you. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's guest. Success is a process, not an event. Hello, and welcome to the Fire in the Belly show. Today we have myself, Mighty Pete, and we're joined by Andy Petick. Good afternoon. Is it good afternoon or good morning to you? I always get confused.
Early afternoon. Thanks so much.
This is the joy of having multi-continental, you know, sort of different time zones we go through. So listen, Andy, welcome to the show. It's always have the great new people on and sort of meet people who are passionate. So Andy, tell us, who are you, what do you do, and where are you from?
Great. My name is Andy Petick. I live in Denver, Colorado. I'm from Seattle, Washington. Do a lot of work in the Pacific Northwest, but relocated a few years ago to the Rockies. I own a marketing agency, and we do product development for wineries and breweries and other food and beverage companies. So I started my career in beverage distribution and retail analytics, and ended up starting a brewery. And in the startup days of the beer company, I brokered for several companies. I designed labels. I went to school for marketing and graphic arts. And so all along I had done freelance design and got into labels. But after owning a brewery, I got very accustomed to the federal tax and trade bureaus, liquor control boards, food and drug administration, all of those things, organic certifications. So all of the crazy work that goes into even copywriting and trademarks, I got really good at developing products. So my my claim to fame is having been able to take a product from a napkin to grocery channel within 90 days, which is extremely difficult in the liquor business because getting federal approval for recipes and labels can take time. But my company's developed over 100 products that are for sale throughout North America and abroad. And in 2020, I was running a podcast, and one of my social media coordinators asked if she could become the producer of it. And I said, Emily, that's real cute. I like it, but our podcast doesn't make any money. It's just really for fun and to connect with people. And I said, so if we're going to do this, we're going to need to bring on some other podcasts to produce to pay for it. And crazy enough, one became two, two became five. Now I own a podcasting network. We're producing 1,000 episodes this year, and we produce 35 shows. And then we have a public network with about 20 podcasts that we own. And we just passed our 1-year anniversary, kind of a test period. And now we're branching into streaming TV, some business networking platforms, book publishing. So our whole thing is changing the landscape of online storytelling by empowering unique and talented people that wouldn't otherwise have a mic to speak to. So when we first set out to find podcast hosts, we had 12,000 applications in the first month. And unfortunately, it was in the middle of a global pandemic, and a lot of people had professional radio background, professional broadcast TV background, had run podcasts. There were a lot of people that were way overqualified to be taking a small gig running a podcast on a whim. And it really showed us that the interest in this is crazy. And I had pitches for live. There was one guy that wanted to do songwriting. They were going to bring in a full kit, and they wanted to record in person every week, showing the process of writing a song and jamming out on video. I had a teacher at the New York University Film School that wanted to bring an 8-person acting cast on every week and act out plays from up and coming playwrights. We've had just everything under the sun. People that wanted to do an anonymous podcast about what it's like to be a stripper. People that wanted to do sports betting, which just got legalized in 28 US states. We've had just about everything, and sex and drugs. And we call ourselves a positive vibes network. So we avoid politics, we avoid religion, And for now, we avoid sports just because it's so competitive. We have some alternative cycling, climbing, that sort of stuff. But really, it's been a unique endeavor being a guy that comes from a marketing background to owning a media company. I, you know, have worked adjacent industries, but it's been extremely rewarding and empowering to have. I've got 100 people that produce all these programs with us, and we're doing a couple million streams this year. And it's pretty unique to be a challenger brand, because in, well, globally, there are about six or seven companies that are worth between 200 and 600 million US dollars. And those have all been gobbled up in the past 2 years by Amazon, Spotify, and SiriusXM Pandora and iHeartRadio. So from the 150 to $200 million valuation mark, there is this Herculean leap down to like 2 million maybe. And so there aren't startup podcasting networks, because it comes at an extremely high cost. When you're starting a ton of things from zero, you can't just immediately foster an audience unless you already are a huge influencer or athlete or whatever. And we've spoken to a couple of the reality TV star kind of folks, or, you know, the TikTok celebrities, I guess. But we've really spent our time working with a lot of coaches and authors and academics and people that are creating more lifestyle content, yogis, outdoorsy people, just really family, therapists, a lot of just really lifestyle and happiness. I do a lot of public work in mental health, and it's something that is right at the forefront of our business and all of my activities. So in the largest nutshell, across the Atlantic to you, that's who I am.
what's beer got to do with the podcast, right? That's the one thing. I mean, it's a beautiful jump, but it is definitely a bit of a left turn at some point, right? So, but both of them are very viable by the sense of it.
A couple of years ago, I had a beer podcast. It was absolutely terrible, like the quality, but I cruised around to breweries and interviewed them about their stories. And really, it was a marketing tool. I didn't care if I had thousands of listeners, because I was about facing the brewery owner and giving them value-added content, which got my foot in the door where I could go see them in person, taste all the beers, show them my chops. And so it was really just a networking thing. And when I moved to Colorado, I had spent the past 30 years living in Washington State. I grew up in Eastern Washington. I lived in Seattle for the past 10 years before that. And I moved to Denver and didn't know anyone. So I started a podcast called Coloradopreneurs, where I profile Colorado-based business people. And it was kind of the same thing. It was just to meet people, and it was for fun. But it completely crossed over from like dude with cameras and microphone to now I'm the CEO of a business that is going to be doing 50 podcasts in 2022. So it's a fun thing to do. I gave myself 1 year to figure out whether or not this business was going to work and have runway to take care of my employees or pivot if it didn't work, because we are completely privately financed and we were, as you can imagine, subsidizing this thing for the first year. So we've had a couple of unicorns that I didn't think were going to be very good that have ended up performing outstandingly. And we've had a couple that came in with high hopes that nobody really latched onto. So we've kind of just gone in really organic test directions. When we first started, we had a guy who had a show about sports betting or golf betting. He's a golf pro in Florida. And he would talk about last week's tournament, next week's tournament, the Masters, the British Open, whatever. But sports betting, as I mentioned, had just been legalized in half of our country. And so rather than being the number 300 golf podcast, we tried to be like the number 4 golf betting podcast. So for 26 of the 30 minutes, he would just talk about golf like everybody else. But then for 4 minutes, he would talk about betting spreads and maybe more than 4 minutes. But we tried to kind of hack the categories on the podcasting platforms. We had a guy that did basketball sneaker fashion. And he set out to interview people from Nike and Adidas and Puma And same thing, he would talk about the basketball games, but we talked about culture and fashion. And that put us, a basketball podcast, into fashion and pop culture categories, which obviously there are no other basketball podcasts competing in. So we've tried a lot of really odd things. And as I mentioned, some of them have just completely blown up in our face, but we employ and we partner with really good humans, and it's been a fascinating endeavor.
So it's coming across as almost a bit of a superpower of yours there, Andy, that, you know, that sort of ability to, you know, to spot an idea, to give it some nurturing and some space and creativity, and let it see if it thrives, it thrives. And if it, you know, doesn't, it doesn't. But is that fair? Is that something that you enjoy, the creative process, and you enjoy the nurturing?
Probably to a fault. Yes. I think in the past 10 years, I've tried a lot of things. I just started my 21st business that I've been involved in. There have been some colossal failures. There have been some falling on the face. You dive deep with people. This is the fire in the belly. I have had businesses that were affected by life changes, and I've had businesses that were affected by personal health, economic impact, things that are outside of your control. So right now, I am actually in the process of starting a nonprofit foundation for mental health for small business owners and entrepreneurs, because at least in my country, the medical insurance is extremely expensive. It's a system that is highly, highly argued over. And more than ever, self-employed Americans are foregoing traditional medical insurance because it's too expensive. Because private plans are really, really costly if you don't have a regular everyday employer. And so they look at industries that have high stress, like doctors, attorneys, firefighters, policemen. And there's a lot of research around their propensity to have anxiety, depression, divorce, suicide, everything. And small business is so broad. And now you have the gig economy where people are doing driving for Uber or doing Etsy stores where they're selling crafts, whatever it is. There just aren't a lot of resources for people in the education space, in the mental and physical services space. So I guess my point is, if people are shelling out to pay for private medical insurance, 9 times out of 10, it doesn't include mental health, if not 10 times out of 10. So we're doing a lot of work in trying to figure out solutions for people. And we're doing a 3-year research study where we're trying to interview 10,000 small business owners in a qualified database that we can take to policymakers. So we're working with some academic researchers and some people in the psychology field, but huge, huge undertones in my life. I have had a divorce that caused me to lose a business. I've had businesses that caused me to lose relationships. I've been sued by my best friends. I've lost acquaintances. I've had personal health issues. To answer your question the longest way, I love starting things. And I come across as a grass is always greener kind of guy, because I love to chase waves and consistently just smash my head into the wall, being a crash test dummy for if ideas are going to work. But I have I've fallen on my face enough times that it's galvanized me as a coach and mentor, because I've pretty much experienced everything that you don't want to happen to you. So at one point I was writing a book that was going to be called Throw 10 Darts, One Might Stick. And now I'm finishing a book that I've been writing for quite a while now that is about kind of a what's the worst that could happen kind of thing, walking through what people are actually afraid of as a small business owner or young professional.
How does that fuel you? I mean, it's a really interesting strategy there, that, you know, as you say, you've tried lots of things, you know, some have gone so well, some not so much. But I mean, is that a strategy of yours, do you think, that actually you've got to gain that experience and let's do it hard, fast, get it done, and, you know, either rip the plaster off and be done with it, or let's let it shine, really. Is that a fair strategy, do you think?
I wouldn't say it's always advisable. There's, in the startup world, especially in technology, people put the Silicon Valley in California on a pedestal, right? And they put these hubs of technology like Seattle, New York City, London, where there are tons of these tech businesses. And usually in that landscape, your resume is not valued based on the number of successful endeavors you've been a part of, but the number of failed businesses you've been a part of, because it shows your grit, your ability to bounce back, the lessons that you learned. So I've never started a business where we had venture capital or we had a incubator, traditional investing. They've all been privately funded or just end over end perpetuated with cash flow snowball. So a couple of things that I've been a part of, if they had started with $100,000, could have become a $10 million business in a year, but we started with $0 and they became a fraction of that or never. So I do think that I've never gone all in on something where it was my full livelihood. I wasn't doing any teaching or consulting or other peripheral things. I think I've sort of done myself as an entrepreneur a disservice in not having hyper-focus, because you're always hedging your bets, which is really common in our industry and in the world of small business. And other things come along. I ended up investing in a barber shop here in Denver, and that has nothing to do with anything that I do. And I've had several clients that couldn't pay their bills or something and offered some kind of equity or stock. And so I'm a partial investor in several things, mostly in sweat because I'm too much of a nice guy to turn people down. Or I have this other demon of not being able to do work that is less than your best. So if they're not able to pay for the thing that you're able to provide, usually I end up in some kind of emotional attachment to clients and going further down the rabbit hole and doing the human answer. So the answer is yes, starting new things and trying things is great, but there are some things that I've been a part of in the past that could have gone a lot further if I had gone all in or taken on financing or really, really laid it all out on the line for. But as I mentioned, I have had things that were going great. They got taken away from me from outside factors, including a pandemic. And that's one of the reasons why my team shifted into this media business, because the marketing company got to a point where I was getting handwritten notes from clients that said, "I'm terribly sorry, but I can't afford to pay you anymore. And we've been working together for 2 years and I can't make this invoice. I think I'll be able to pay by next month. Are you going to throw me away or not?" And I do not have the heart. You know, I literally cried multiple times getting someone. I was always wondering why they were mailing me a paper check. And it's because it was coming with a note. And you always know when you see something with a stamp on it that the waterworks are coming soon. But we ended up taking on a ton of clients that were just not in our wheelhouse. We do food and beverage and consumer products. So we've done yoga pants and mountain bikes and other light manufacturing. But we were taking on these tiny mom and pop food companies that were specifically here in Colorado, whereas we were used to working with companies across the US and abroad. But we had all these things where we were doing just social media. And all of a sudden we had speech language pathologists that work with kids. We had an LGBTQ clothing brand. We had a couple therapists. We had a dentist. You know, we had all these people that were great human beings, but we're never going to put on our website. We're never going to tell people we did. And it just kind of became all money is green sort of stuff. So rather than having a couple massive retainer clients, we had a lot of small, I call them subscription clients, where instead of having people that are paying you $20,000 to $40,000, $50,000 a year, and you have 5 to 10 clients, we were having 50 to 60 clients that were paying us $500 a month to do their Instagram. And that is nauseating because there's a lot of customer service. And it just becomes services that I particularly didn't care about. clients that I wasn't super interested in, things that were really high maintenance. And so I ended up letting one of my partners take several of those clients and go off and do something different. And I started a clean slate with the podcasting thing. So we still had, you know, our core clients at the marketing agency, but it was very odd to run a beverage marketing agency for 10 years and then just say, I'm going to take a year and put the thing that I'm an expert at on ice to do something that I'm not really an expert at. And I hired a full-time producer. We have several editors. We have copywriters. We have people that, you know, do podcasting as their full-time job. And we've really built this thing as a complete experiment. And it's, I can't say that I'm all in. I own a couple other businesses and I personally am always hedging, but it's been a really fun endeavor and it's been a conduit to several other things. I can reach out to pretty much anyone because I own a podcast media network. And so when it comes to like press passes for Comic-Con or a movie festival or trying to get bigger celebrity interviews or something, we're a challenger brand. Nobody knows whether we have 50 million listeners or just my mom. You know, at the end of the day, with podcasting, one of the things that I love is if you create excellent content, nobody knows how many listeners you have. So if it's not the fake it till you make it thing, but it's if you're adding value to someone and providing something that they can use to promote themselves. I own a publicity company where we do booking for people on all different kinds of medium from blogging up to national television. And so we book people on podcasts. And some of them say, I want to pre-vet how many listeners this gets, how many streams it gets. I want to know how much reach I'm going to have. The problem with that is that doesn't mean that it's going to do anything for you. I have some podcast hosts that their episodes get, well, clients of ours at least, that get, say, 70 downloads, but they're getting in-person clients that are paying them thousands of dollars because of that, because we work with so many coaches. Versus somebody who's got a podcast that's about video games or something, and they don't have an in-person business to convert sales in, and they're doing it just for fun, for impact, you get on that one and you may not be converting sales. So we have created this opportunity to really bring value in a way that is tailored to each person. For instance, if I was going on a podcast, if they're creating really great content, I wouldn't care how big their reach is, because if they're creating really great content, I can turn around and promote that episode to my audience, because I host four podcasts, but I very rarely get interviewed. And so you don't hear my story for an hour. And that's the case with a lot of our clients. We have one client who hired a gigantic agency in New York, and they got them into Vogue and Condé Nast and Robb Report and all these big magazines. But they didn't get any sales out of that. And they paid thousands and thousands of dollars for it, versus we get them on a couple small podcasts that are in their industry niche and they're converting sales. So it's fascinating, the world of podcasting as a tool for converting sales, creating digital products, creating membership-based stuff. I have a podcast that's about podcasting. It goes around in a loop. I have a podcast called The Cast of Pods. Very cheeky. I love it. But I teach people how to make money podcasting, and it's just got some general lessons. We use it as a kind of intake class for people that hire our production company. So we have, I think, 19 podcasts that we own and operate. And then we produce podcasts for another 20, 25 companies that hire us to do so. And we're pretty limited in what we accept, because it needs to be something that is scalable or somebody that's going to be a real client long-term. But it's so fun that people that are willing to invest in telling stories on the internet, you know, it's pretty cool.
No, totally.
I don't have to tell you.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing process. And I mean, what have you learned from that? I mean, there's a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm and ideas have gone in there for you, you know. And I mean, what how would you summarize that for you? And what have you learned so far, do you think?
I personally, my downfall as an entrepreneur and investor is that I am an empath. And I really, really get emotionally attached to every client. I have a hard time firing bad clients. I have a hard time taking on stuff that I shouldn't be. I really care about the little guys. And that's one of the reasons why going from working one-on-one as a consultant to owning an agency where my team is working with a lot of small people and we're able to take them on, to working in public speaking where I can affect an audience, to working in podcasting network where we're affecting 100 times the audience or 1,000 times the audience, but my direct connection is more at a 50,000 foot level. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been my way to succeed, is putting all of my energy and love into my people and having them put it into their people and then put it out to the audience. So we publish on our podcast, we publish, I don't know, maybe 30 episodes a week. So I don't even get to listen to all of ours anymore. And it's, I personally host a couple of podcasts and they're all just kind of pet interest things. I've got a national search right now for a co-host for a Star Wars podcast because I have a lot of feelings about that. But anyhow, it's been a unique lesson for me. Since I come from a product development background, typically if you start a podcast and you want to make money doing it, you do it for a couple of years. Maybe you grow your audience enough to have a couple of banner ads on your website. Or maybe somebody wants to give you an affiliate sponsorship where you're talking about yoga pants and you get $2 for sale with a discount code or something. But usually it's like you wait 3 or 4 years, maybe you put out some kind of online course, and then maybe you create some kind of product or a retreat, maybe a conference, something. But that's like where you want to get to when you get big. We went the opposite route. So we chose people specifically to work with that already have a coaching business, a writing business, or organizer of events, something like that, where we can immediately put out products. So we are publishing 6 books this fall. We have a gal that's patenting a water bottle for bodybuilders. We have several people that obviously can do merchandise, Patreon, all those sort of things. But we pick people where we can immediately market products and go in the opposite direction of the normal revenue model, where we didn't do any advertising in our first year. And we still are starting very, very select sponsorships that are tied to in-person events and other things. Whereas 90% of the industry is financed specifically by advertising and sponsorship dollars. And you look at companies like Barstool Sports, which is the biggest podcasting company, and most of their revenue comes from selling products to college kids, selling all the merch and everything. Every time one of their podcast hosts says some funny thing, it becomes a catchphrase that's going on sweatshirts. Or they have all of this white label product stuff where they have branded vodka and branded whatever. And now they're going on to own betting organizations, event organizations, sports franchises, all of that sort of stuff. So we kind of tried to set out going the opposite way and figured if we're going to make any money, we need to find people at the beginning that already have a book to sell or already have a course to sell, and or maybe already have an audience, and then wheel that into listenership. And I've seen some that just completely fail. I've seen some people that have 100,000 followers on Instagram, and you combine TikTok and all their other things, and they've got a huge platform, but then nobody listens to their podcast because maybe it's unrelated. Maybe they have a huge following for being a photographer or a model or something, but then their podcast is about relationships. You never know. But to answer your question about what I've learned, it's a passion game. In 2018, there were 500,000 podcasts globally. Now there's more than 2 million within a year and a half. And I guess it was beginning of 19. And that's a lot. Is there a saturation point? Maybe. Is it really hard to get into a space like 5 guys talking about American football? Yes. Is it very difficult to get into a space talking about pop culture and celebrity dating? Yes. It's very hard. The biggest category in podcasting is true crime, horror, and scripted drama. So people love the murdery stuff. They love the it's kind of like the 1950s huddled around the radio, listening to your serial story. People are going into this serialized programming, and there's a company out of California called Parcast that got bought by Spotify for $190 million or something. And they do all that. They have about 30 shows, and they're all true crime, scripted drama, murder, horror, dark and weird stuff. Americans are into dark and weird stuff. But that's like 25% of podcasts. It's crazy. And then sports is huge. Politics are huge. But it's very interesting that we haven't tried to compete in the spaces that have the most competition, but those are also the ones that have the most eyeballs. I have a podcast right now that is about zoos. This guy is a professional musician. He's a drummer, and he travels around the country playing with bands and symphonies and stuff. He's a gig musician. He's a very good one. And he started out going to zoos in every town that he goes to. And he got to the point where he started interviewing zookeepers. And then he started getting to pet animals. And then he's a good photographer and he takes pictures of animals. And now he's got like the top zookeeping podcast in the US. And I'm on the computer, right? Like the listenership is huge. And I don't know if they're all people that work at zoos or if people just love animals. But we literally have a podcast every week where this guy just goes to zoos and turns on the mic and talks to people about, and he knows the names of every red panda at every zoo in North America. And he knows all these people that are like the Michael Jordan of wrangling giraffes or whatever. So we also have a show that we launched recently that is called Spycraft 101. And our host works in, let's say he lives in Langley, Virginia. He works in an intelligence agency, and he travels around the world doing undisclosed things. And he has a podcast about spycraft, the Cold War, James Bond stuff, gadgets, you know, cars. And every week he tells crazy stories. He interviews people that were foreign operatives and people that know technology and literally watches that shoot darts and birds that are mechanical and bombs that look like dog poop. I mean, it was like the craziest things. He just published his first book with us. It's on Amazon. It's called Spy Shots. It's 101 short stories of unexplainable spy things. And you would not believe some of these weird gadgets and stories. A lot of it is Cold War era stuff, but I didn't think that would be a big podcast, and it's the biggest one in our network. It's gigantic. So it's very weird that you would expect. I had a gal that we've been working with that has a podcast for children's yoga, and she hundreds of thousands of downloads. I mean, she rocks. So it's very funny. You wouldn't think people would want to listen to an audio program about cooking. It's kind of a visual thing. And that also goes to the crossover with YouTube. Do you have to have a video channel? If you have a video channel, should you be publishing an audio? There's a popular guy, Gary Vaynerchuk, calls it the triple threat. You record it in video, you cut it into audio, and you also have it transcribed into blog. And that way you can harvest your guests' following. So if I post this interview to everybody that I know on all of our channels, obviously all of them are going to go and follow you. And the more people you have on, the bigger your network gets because you can harvest their following. But one of the things that I find really interesting is recently there's a podcast called The Token CEO. Erica Nardini is the CEO of Barstool Sports. And she interviews people in their organization every week. And she talks about what it's like to manage the world's biggest podcasting company. And she said that when she joined the company in 2017 or 2018, they had 15 social media accounts and now they have 1,500. So all of those brands they have TikTok and YouTube and Snapchat and multiple Instagram accounts. But you can imagine, I think at that time they had 10 employees and now they have like 300 or 400 employees. It's nuts what it takes to commercialize online media, because you could be in a recording studio on Abbey Road in London, or you could be some guy in his basement in Calgary, Ontario, and Calgary's in Alberta. Sorry about that, Canada. But you can be some random person, and if you have a good microphone, you can make it sound like it's studio quality. And the difference between the amateur guy in his basement playing video games and super high-end music studios is not that much when you're streaming it over the internet. The margin of those 2 million podcasts is not that far. And headphones are going to continue getting better. Microphones are going to continue getting cheaper. We're democratizing storytelling, which is cool, but it's also scary if you're putting all your money into owning a podcasting company because you don't know where the landscape's going. Hopefully I'm not like the Laserdisc or the HD DVD or something.
I mean, do we get to the point where actually it's not down to quantity, it's down to quality? Do you think that happened? Is happening already that, as you say, there's no lack of, say, sports podcasts out there. So people start to get picky, you know, and they really sort of really start sifting through and saying, you got to stand out. You got to, you know, as you say, you got to follow through with the content. You got to tag guests. You got to do the social media push. You got to do all those things, right? Or else you're just going to, you're going to tread water, and you're going to take home water actually, and probably just not last.
I think so. It's a lot of podcasters go on podcasts, or a lot of media people feel obligated to have a podcast. Now there's a lot of celebrities getting in the game that can just will a following. And it's interesting. My head producer is very, very obsessive about the garbage words. Like, you know, I mean, all that stuff, and taking out pauses and leveling audio, and every one of our programs needs to be perfect. And sometimes you listen to a podcast that are on the most popular channels in the world, and it sounds like they're recording it in their car sometimes, or there's dogs barking in the background or whatever. And you think, wow, we spend a lot of labor and a lot of salary on taking out this extra 2 hours of audio engineering. Is that necessary? And to us, it's make or break. Like, if you listen to one of our podcasts, our brand isn't uniform enough to where if you listen to one show, you have a reason to listen to one of our other 20 shows. They're very independent because they're very different. There's a podcasting network based in Texas, I believe, called Betches, Betches. And there's like Betches Politics, Betches Housewives. They're like, there's one about The Bachelor, there's one about reality TV, there's one about politics, but they all have consistent, like all of the album art looks the same. And the hosts cross over into different programs and they are set up as a channel on Apple Podcast. So if you listen to one of their programs, you're incentivized to listen to 8 of their programs. And my favorite podcasting network is called The Ringer. It was started by a guy who broke away from ESPN and took a couple of producers, Bill Simmons. And I listened to a show called The Big Picture, which is about movies and cinema and the entertainment industry. But they also have one that's about TV. They also have one that's about legacy cinema. And the hosts go back and forth across the banners. So you look forward to following one guy as he goes on a different show the next week. And they bring experts from that one over here. And all of a sudden, I'm a subscriber of 3 or 4 shows listening to the same hosts. And that's what you eventually want to get to. Our problem is our stuff is so stinking different. A couple of our hosts have been able to be guests on other shows, but it's almost hard to even line up relevance because there are none of them in the same lane, which is exciting, but a little scary because we set out to just test so many different things. Throw 10 darts, one might stick. I feel like I should trademark that. You can have it in the UK.
And tell me this, but the likes of Clubhouse and stuff. I mean, what's your take on that? Is it going to take? Is it not? Is it a threat to podcasting? Is it not? What's your gut feel?
I tried Clubhouse for one day and I got a lot of anxiety. I felt like a ton of wasted time. I sat there and waited and waited and waited, and I got pulled up to the top of this really big one. It was cool. A bunch of people followed me on Clubhouse. But then they didn't go and follow me on any of the channels that I regularly act on. Have you been a clubber?
I'm not that far off yourself. I sort of dipped in. It can't be, it's, let's just say the mic gets handed around rather freely and people get, you know, people qualified, unqualified, whatever, get ear space. And it's like, you know what? I'm busy enough. Thanks.
Everybody wanted to pitch their stuff and interrupt each other, or the trick is promoting someone else. And then they say, oh, you need to hear this guy. And then they feel obligated to pull him up. And they just do this weird back and forth. It's very difficult. I want to know what, I mean, obviously you've done a ton of episodes of this podcast and talked to a lot of people and given them a forum to just really go in any direction. What have you learned in the time that you've been doing this?
I think a huge amount, really. I mean, I sort of started with an open agenda in that, you know, listen, I genuinely believe if, you know, if you have a breath in your lungs and a beat in your heart, you have a fire in your belly. I believe we're all born with it. I love your passion, and that's the thing. You know, I think passion is one of the most common answers when I ask people, what does fire in the belly mean to them? You know, passion is the number one answer by a completely unstatistic, probably 80%+. And that's the thing. And it just, I think when you find your passion, it's like, you know, work excites you instead of drains you. You know, that's the difference. You know, it's not, we don't even call it work. I mean, we're enthused to do more, try more, be more. And as you say, it's not a case of, oh, there's a failed business. It's kind of going, no, well, cool, that's okay. We're going to try something different. We're going to, you know, you bounce off it. You don't get drowned by it. And that's the beauty. It's non-political. It's non-geographical. It's non, you know, it doesn't matter what color, creed, religion, whatever it is. And I think anyone that has passion. So that's the one thing I've learned. I mean, I've got to interview the weird and wacky and wonderful, you know, and people who are passionate about sharks right through to, you know, 12-year-old entrepreneurs. But when people start talking about their passion, it's actually quite, it's addictive. You take on their energy and suddenly you're bouncing and going, I'm so excited for you. I'm enthusiastic. And it's going, I know nothing about your business, but I'm enthusiastic for you because they're giving off so much energy, you know. But that's similar to like with podcasts, right? You know, and with anything, any industry, if someone's talking passionately with it, it's hard not to get wrapped up in what they're saying, you know. And you talk passionately about, you know, marketing, you talk passionately about what you do and the podcast there, and it's hard not to get wrapped up and going, that sounds really, really cool, you know. Does that make sense?
I love how it makes you, it seems obvious because it's long form content, but it makes you feel like you're a part of something that other people don't know. It's like, if you listen to a podcast for a couple of years, you feel like you know that person. You listen to them for hours. You don't spend that much time with a lot of your friends or coworkers. And so it's very interesting that you have the ability to, you may say things redundantly week in and week out or with different guests. And it's kind of like going out in the evening or going to a party or something or a networking event. I'm kind of an introvert and I always dread going to these things, but then I go and I'm so glad that I went, right? 9 times out of 10, it turns out to be great. And it's the same way. My team books a lot of people onto my podcasts or me onto some appearances. And usually I'm pretty choosy, but sometimes it's like, oh, I have 3 podcast interviews today and I don't know who any of them are. I have to look it up. And I'm like, not really sure if I want to do this. And then I'm double booked into something. And then I do the interview and every one of them, they send me a copy of their book or they ask if we want to help sell their program or if our staff wants to try out their product or go see my thing on Amazon. And immediately I want to like go evangelize for them, because I feel like I'm part of their tribe. Like I've figured out something that other people haven't figured out. And every podcast that I've ever appeared on and every person that I've ever had on one of my shows, or really on all of our podcasts, I feel like they're part of our family. And the fact that you can recruit one of those every couple of days is pretty cool. And you were telling me before we started recording, almost 400, you said?
Yeah, we've done over, I mean, it's super interesting. We've done over 400 interviews. We've released 230 30 odd episodes. I have quite a high spoil rate on this show. In that, for anyone that sort of hasn't heard me talk about it before, but about 30% of our interviews will never go live. And that's simply because we do tend to go a little bit deeper, or we go a little more personal. That means then my number one aim is to have a beautiful conversation. My number two is that we can release it as an interview that is publicly available. So my commitment is always to the guest. But as a result, we end up talking about things maybe that they haven't talked about before publicly, or they weren't ready to share. So as a result, we end up with quite a few interviews, and our commitment to the guest is if you say no, then it's a no. It's quite simply. So, but for that, I feel very, very privileged to have been able to share that, have been able to be in that moment, have been able to ask the question that sort of had them scratching their head and suddenly unpeeling something in their mind. You know, it's a beautiful thing. It's very personal, right? You know, and sometimes you have to sort of point and go, and by the way, guys, we are recording, just to
right,
just to pull you back a little bit.
Sure.
You know,
those can be the best ones. It's hard to find that equilibrium between wanting to look professional and be taken seriously and being who you are. It's very difficult because I have employees all over the place within a 10,000 mile radius, and I work virtually with the team all the time. I run multiple businesses from a laptop, but day by day, I'm a dude in downtown Denver at the coffee shop wearing shorts and a backpack. And these things have become more culturally acceptable with the startup culture of, you know, introverted weirdos that wear hoodies. But I go out and do photo shoots, and I do art, and I do my own graphic design, and I do stuff that I get to choose to do because passion is first and foremost to me. But a lot of the people that know me here at our headquarters have no idea that we have programs that are syndicated around the world and all of this. And I like it that way because I'm a guy, not as in I'm a male, but I'm a human. And it's, I'm finishing this book that I've been trying to write for about 3 years now. And it's very, very open. And it's difficult because first it was going to be called Throw 10 Darts, One Might Stick. Then it was going to be called Everything You Don't Want to Happen to You Before You Turn 30. And so I've been writing this book, and I want to, sorry, catch my breath here. I live at 10,000 feet. Well, I live at 5,800 feet, but you never get used to the Colorado altitude. It's like my place in Seattle is at 50 feet. It's like looking at the ocean, and here it's like you go up and down the stairs and you just feel like you're going to die. Anyway, I've been trying to write this book for a couple of years, and it's very, very exposing. It's very raw. And I have had fear several times that it was going to make me look less legitimate as a boss or as a professional, because I have a lot of clients that count on me. I have businesses that I've invested in, and I didn't become a successful entrepreneur by multiplying one thing. I've tried 1,000 things. And one of the things that makes me valuable as a partner to people is I'm more loyal than a basset hound, and I will take it to the end. But in 2017, had a really horrible summer. I had some personal health issues. I had some mental health issues. And I've had long bouts with anxiety and depression, and I had never experienced, I ended up going to the hospital. I had a really, really hardcore panic attack and some other physiological things that came up as a result of it. And for anybody who's taken antidepressant medication, a bevy of side effects come, and it can be sleep stuff. It can be sexual stuff. It can be diet stuff, but you end up having to move around for months just to be able to mitigate the side effects of adjusting your day and your diet. And I went years barely sleeping, and I went to a lot of psychotherapy and all these things, but owned a business with some people that I shouldn't have gone into business with. I went into business with some friends, and they both stopped contributing in the first year. And when it was guys doing a crafty hobby on the weekends, it was fine. But when I quit my big corporate job to do it full time, they immediately both evaporated. And one of them was traveling the world doing weird things. The other one started a family, and his wife meddled a lot. And when you start a business, you don't think very often about the fact that there are not only the characters that you're getting into bed with, but their spouses and their families, not just their impact on that person. But if one of your business partners gets divorced, does their now former spouse take stock in your business? Are you putting careful measures into place that protect you? So I ended up going into business with one of my best friends from growing up and a very close family friend of my ex-wife. And it got really difficult because I had these people that owned 50% of my business, but they weren't contributing labor, they weren't contributing capital, and they would not give up stock. So for 4 years, I ran a company with two hands tied behind my back. I couldn't raise money. I couldn't hire employees. I had to do it by myself. So I traveled all over the West Coast of the US. I sold product into thousands of stores. This is the brewery I mentioned. And I was managing dozens of distributors, hundreds of sales reps, thousands of accounts. And I was the only full-time employee for 4 years. And it was just pure grit. But I would come home from work. And I mean, you just said you want people to open up about what they haven't said out loud before. So I would come home from work, and my now ex-wife wasn't super hyped on hearing how my day went, because I'm going to come home and complain about this person that is practically a family member to her. And my in-laws ended up not really interested in my success or failure, because they were hearing from my partner's parents, because they were all high school sweethearts together. And it just kind of became this huge cluster that went beyond the person that I was involved with is a good human, a great person who I loved. And it, when we started it, we pictured this fun thing that eventually our kids would inherit, and they'd be running around with dogs and whatever. I was the one that forced it to become a big commercial endeavor and tried to go big. And I tried to sell our business. My only way out was getting acquired and out of this issue. And the valuations were really bad. And every offer that I was able to get involved me going to work for the companies for 4 or 5 years. And my partners being able to just collect royalties for the rest of time. And I had to go and work on a tiny salary and be an indentured servant so I could get out of this. And I had that situation with a company in San Diego, and several months went by and my partners more or less blocked the deal. They wouldn't sign the contracts because they didn't think they were getting enough money. And then I had another company in Oregon that was going to do the same thing, didn't go through. I had another company in Washington that was going to do the same thing. One of these companies I had already gone to work for. I was carrying a business card. I was running their brands, and my signature and the attorneys, they were already pretty much signed. And I had business partners, and I made a huge mistake. And I ended up buying the business out. You know, I bought from them at the same terms, which were absolutely terrible. And it took me to a point where the business was going fine. I'd been doing it for years. The forecast was good. But 2 months later, I had a bunch of personal health issues and mental health issues, and I wasn't able to work for a couple months. And as soon as I defaulted on the royalties to them, one of them had made me sign a personal guarantee. And so when I couldn't personally make all of the payments to them, they sued me immediately. So I went a year and a half of trying to sell the business and going further and further into personal and professional debt because the deals were already done. And then I bought the company. I only got to own it for 3 months and everything came crashing down. So in 2017, my parents got divorced after 35 years. Then I got sued. I lost one of my businesses. I lost all of my consulting clients because I was living in my basement watching Netflix for 6 months because I could barely go outside because I was having health issues. And then I went through this drawn out lawsuit. I got sued by two parties in the same summer. and they forced me into personal bankruptcy. My only way to get out from under it was to file bankruptcy. And you can imagine the amount of shame that came with this, because it had nothing to do with my abilities or prowess as a entrepreneur. I jumped on a grenade for 45 people and 42 of them effed me. So that whole empathic thing that I was telling you about, I lost everything. I mean, overnight I lost probably $500,000 or $600,000 and my business that I spent 4 years building. And they sued me for the intellectual property and the recipes and all that stuff. And then they never did anything with it. So not, I didn't even get to like move forward and say, look at this big shiny thing that it's like Steve Wozniak, you know, he like wasn't part of Apple, but he's always the co-founder of Apple. I don't even get that because it doesn't exist anymore. And so I moved out to Colorado with the clothes on my back and a leased Subaru. And that was it. I had before that wife and a house and dogs and tons of clients. I owned a couple businesses. I had the American dream for 20 something. And I started over with $0. I had to live in cash. I got a credit card with a $300 limit. I had more than that when I was 12. And it really just derailed me, not just personally, but professionally and mentally, because I came out to a new market where I didn't know anyone. And I pretty much didn't talk to, I erased my life up to the age of 30. I'm now 34. But it pretty much, I started over from scratch and I didn't speak to anyone from my hometown, anyone from my professional life after university. And I went to a place where I had so much shame because I grew up in an environment where a lot of the people that I knew had a lot of money. And I grew up in a upper middle class Caucasian family in the Pacific Northwest, the United States. And I got to travel abroad as a kid. And I had a lot of, you know, my family wasn't wealthy, but they did everything for my brother and I. And so all of this is to say that everybody has to decide what success means to them. And it took me a long time and a lot of hours on the couch with the therapist to figure out that my self-worth was not based on what other people thought of me and or based on money, because it always was. When I quit my day job and started a brewery, everybody thought that was really cool. Oh, he's the one with courage and he's going to make it big. Maybe, maybe not. And when I had to be at a beer festival pouring beer every weekend, these people that were next to me were sending their like 50th employee who was a college kid on an internship who's pouring beer for free. I didn't have any employees. I was out every night riding around in a car, trying to sell restaurants, doing competitions and brewer dinners and festivals and all these things. And I was like the one person. One time I stood for 12 hours without going to the bathroom and poured pints of beer. So it really, I went from an environment where I was selling big corporate deals all the time and having that instant gratification to when you are self-employed, there isn't always somebody to pat you on the back. And that's why I have found later in my career now and reinventing, obviously, that you are able to connect with people and affect them, but they say successful entrepreneurs work on their business, not for their business, right? And I didn't have an opportunity. I would go into meetings with distributors and I would be the one little company that they gave a shot to. And 2 days later, after these big conferences, they would say, that's the best presentation we saw this entire year. Like, we support Miller Coors. We have Stone Brewing. We have huge breweries that have thousands of employees. The very best one that we saw this year was this one guy who's working out of a garage in Woodinville, Washington. But I had to sell blood, sweat, and tears. I was brokering other people's products. I was like the guy with the Inspector Gadget trench coat with all the watches on the inside, the panhandler. I would go to places and I was selling other people's products. I was consulting for other companies. I had to consult for years just to be able to pay to have my business. And I put in 4 years of labor, all my money, and I fell flat on my face. So I've hit professional rock bottom multiple times, and in no situations did it have to do with my ability as an entrepreneur. It always was me laying it all on the line to try to protect my marriage, as it were, or business partnership, personal friendship, hedging economic situations for COVID. And so you asked me at the top of this interview about if constantly trying new things is a valuable business skill. And some of it for me personally has come out of fear of failure, but also I get attached to my employees. I like cultivating and training people. And I found that I was not a wine salesman, and I was not a graphic designer or a photographer. I'm not even a business leader. I really, if you ask me what my superpower is, it's empathy and creativity. I am an idea guy, and I can inspire people to bring out the best in them. And this is what happens in a lot of businesses now, especially the ones we see online. Everybody that's listening to this can reference an experience where they saw someone doing something on YouTube and thought, wow, I could be doing that better than them. Like, I have the skills that are far beyond this person that is dancing on their iPhone, but they're willing to do it. And so you go from, like, maybe you are a personal trainer in a gym and you say, I only have so many hours in the day. I can only train so many people. I want to be more than this. So then you start doing nutrition coaching too. And then maybe you start coaching online so you can reach more people. And then you hire some other coaches to work for you and teach your program. And then you start teaching people how to be a fitness coach. But eventually you start just teaching people how to build courses. And then you start teaching people how to build organizations. And then you start teaching people how to teach. But you have these online gurus that all of a sudden are nowhere near where they started because of how they evolve. And I graduated from college and thought I was going to be a graphic designer at an advertising agency. And now I own a media company making podcasts. It's a lot closer than the route that I took through the beverage industry, but you never know where you're going to end up. And it's taken me, rounding back out to this book, it's been ready for a while. I've rewritten chapters of it a million times, and I got worried about, is this going to embarrass my parents, or is this going to inflame ex-girlfriends, or is this going to make me look like a loser because I'm admitting to the world that I lost all my money? And right now I have a lot of clients that are trusting me with their businesses and their employees and their pocketbooks. And they could say, oh, 5 years ago, this guy had nothing. And that's kind of one of the stories. You hear about people that have unicorn businesses that come up with an idea in a dorm room and make billions, but there's a huge proportion more of people that have fallen on their face. And I have literally gone, peaks and valleys is an understatement. I've literally gone to zero. I had to borrow money from my parents to be able to drive to Colorado so I could live in my mom's basement for a summer. And you can imagine how ashamed I was when all of my clients were calling saying, where are you? But I couldn't make meetings and I didn't know what to do. And obviously what took me 10 years the first time only took me a couple months the second time, or the 10th time, or whatever it is now. But I appreciate that. And I know I've been talking 95% of this interview, but people only ask me about what makes my businesses successful or what tips I have to make their thing better. But really at the bottom of it is, it's undying faith. And if you need to value yourself, self-love, I can go on about morning routines and mindfulness and healthy diet, but I've literally put myself into levels of stress that I think are taking days off the end of my life. You know, my grandma said that to me when I was a little kid, and it's a little morbid, but she would think every time you get super stressed and upset, just think about that amount of stress is physiologically affecting you. And maybe it's 100 years from now, but make that 99 years, 300 and whatever days, you know, like, just think about, you're putting yourself through pain that is in the long term harming you, and it's not worth it. So I am a recovering workaholic. I am a recovering serial entrepreneur, and you choose what you put first in your life. And it's not to say that I put business ahead of relationships. It's actually because I put relationships ahead of business. And I'm 34 and I've been bankrupt. I've been divorced twice. It's not as rock star as it sounds. And it's not all because of business, but it's because I care about everyone and everything. And I put myself on the line, hoping that the universe will give back. And I have loyal employees that will go anywhere with me. And I have loyal team and community. And now my couple dozen employees can have couple dozen podcast hosts, can have thousands of listeners, can have millions of downloads. And whether I'm able to be on the microphone or not, our stories are affecting hundreds of thousands of people. And I hope that a couple people read my book, but if it helps one person, that's all that I care about. And these nonprofit efforts to make change for small business owners, that's all comes back to mental health and storytelling and sharing the human adventure. How about that?
Beautiful. I mean, you know, I'm reflecting as you talk about that, you know, and there's an expression, you know, sometimes good things don't happen so that great things can, which is, it's monumental, and I'm sure all the trials and tribulations you've been through. But, you know, if we look at it the other way and say, well, actually, all these things are just adding to the ammunition pile for actually the big one, you know, for the main thing, you know. But Andy, I want to be very respectful of your time here, you know, and just conscious of that, really. So really, I would sort of ask you and saying is, what if you were to try and describe your fire in the belly, what would that be?
I am motivated by helping make change. I thought I was the guy who felt rewarded by helping other people succeed. And I've built products for other people that have gone on to make a lot of money and no one will ever know that I was a part of. And I've done consulting that has changed the course of businesses. And, you know, hopefully decades later, when those people are millionaires, I can tell the tale that I was a part of it. Everyone has an uncle who had an opportunity to invest in Microsoft in the 80s, you know, who would be rich now. And not to say it's all about money, but I've realized that I can make change for the most people by sharing my experiences and skills, but doing it on a larger level by being able to amplify stories. And I finally found after all these years that it's all in the candor. People appreciate 100% authenticity and nothing less. And so I think the fire in my belly is my willingness to, 2 years ago, no matter how much money I make or the businesses I own, probably 1 year ago, I would have not been able to tell you on your podcast that I filed bankruptcy, because I would have felt like I looked like a loser. Like I had hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. I lost hundreds of thousands of dollars of business and the house and the picket fence and the wife and the dogs and all those things. Those were inevitable to happen anyway. When you get into young relationships, that's a whole separate thing. But the fire in my belly comes from being able to wake up every day and do creative things that create messages to change other people's outlook and future.
Beautiful. Tell us, where can people follow you, track you, hunt you down, stalk you, any of the above?
Every one of my businesses has the word daydreamer in it. For better or worse, that's kind of my the guy staring out the window and helping people's dreams come true. It's kind of a whole cute thing. So my Instagram is daydreampreneur. I guess they all have daydream or preneur in them. And my business accounts, there's we.r.daydreamer.com. Somebody sat on the one without the periods and it's nothing, which bothers me. And then daydreamernetwork.com is the podcasting platform. So a Daydreamer Network is where you can see all the podcasts that we produce. We have audio clips and videos every day. My marketing agency, where you can see all the beer work that we do, is we.r.daydreamer.com. I'm Daydreampreneur. I have several podcasts, but those are the best places to find me. Daydreamernetwork.com gives you a more in-depth idea, and wearedaydreamer.com. And I have had such a pleasure being on here. I'd love to have you on one of my shows. Are those your books in the background?
Yeah. So
I need to read your book. I love this. And I hope this whole community, you gained a fan in me for sure. And I hope I can tell a lot of people to start listening to the fire in the belly, because I know a lot of folks that have it.
Is there a final message you'd like to leave with listeners?
It's never too late to make a leap. I'm not telling you to risk your life savings, but if you have always been thinking about knitting hats and selling them at a farmer's market or about starting a podcast, I've always grappled with the just start method, like do it, even if it's bad, you're going to learn from it, versus the have it be perfect before you start. Don't have it be perfect, just start doing it. Most of the podcasters out there right now will go back and listen to the one that they made 5 years ago with an iPhone and no professional equipment, and they laugh about it, and it's a learning experience for their people, and they leave them published intentionally for that reason. So if you want to start a podcast, I'd be happy to help you. My company would be happy to help you. If you want to publish a book, if you want to make a video channel, we have educational, you know, free materials on all these different platforms to learn from folks. If you're interested in mental health, we have multiple podcasts about that, dating, relationships. Literally, Daydreamer Network is the place for positive vibes. So if you want to learn anything, if you want to create anything of your own, if you need the inspiration, or if you're ready to invest in it and you want us to help make your podcast, go to daydreamernetwork.com and get in touch with us. And I would love to help you. We would love to make thousands of podcasts if I can make sure I can pay for it.
Anything's possible, right?
Right.
It's awesome. Andy, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and really for all your share. So thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Talk to you next time.
Well, that was another great episode of Fire in the Belly. You know, this really wouldn't be possible without our great guests taking the time to share their personal journeys. And boy, oh boy, sometimes it is personal. It's an absolute pleasure to have that, and then to hear the journeys that people have been on. We've loads more episodes coming up soon, and it's always a pleasure to have guests on. If you do happen to know anyone with true fire in their belly, please reach out to us so we can share their journey, lessons, and successes. So, all that's left to say is have a great day, live with fire in your belly, and be the mightiest version of you.